Morning. As you can see, we're in a different place. Baruch Hashem, the voice is on the mend. Not quite there yet. There may be a few coughs around the corner, but we'll work it out. We are in a slightly different place today. It's on. We're rolling. We're good. Shinu Makom, Shinu Mazel, maybe a little bit. So the voice might come back. For the next 2 weeks, this week and next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I think we're going to have a little bit of fun. We're going to, maybe we always have a little bit of fun, but this week and next week specifically, I've picked two topics which I think are really fascinating, very topical, contemporary, and also halachic and hashgafic, and they're both to do with Pesach. This week I would like to talk about the topic of selling chometz, give you a bit of an overview of a very strange mitzvah, or not a mitzvah, a very strange minhag that we have, of selling chometz, and how that works, and whether it works, and the evolution of that. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I would like to talk to you about bringing the Korban Pesach, Bizman Hazeh. Whether there are any opportunities for us to do that halachically, hashkafically. I'll talk a little bit about the people who try every year and like why they do and why other people don't. So next week, hopefully, we will deal with that topic. We will have a share for those of you who are not cleaning or otherwise preparing for Pesach. You can come here and we can prepare for Pesach with a share next week. Then, of course, it'll be Chol HaMoed, there'll be no share, and then the week straight after Pesach, please God, there will be a share once again. So, no share in 2 weeks, but there will be a share next week. Fine. Everyone has a sheet. Does anyone need it? I've got one more left. If anyone needs it, just pass this maybe back. Pass this back to the lady over there. Okay, now we're all out. Okay, if you'd like to look at the sheet in front of you, this is an interesting topic, and by way of an opening remark, I'd like to relate a story that happened to me in Hendon many, many years ago. So one of my friends was at a dinner, which was some kind of interfaith ecumenical dinner, and there was a priest sitting next to him. So they were chatting a little bit, and then they announced they were going to begin the dinner. So my friend picked up his bread roll, it was a Mazonas roll, and he started eating it. So the priest turned around to him and said to him, "One second, don't you have a Jewish law that you have to ritually wash your hands before you eat bread?" So the guy turned around to the priest and said, "Oh, you'll really love this. This is, I'll tell you an interesting thing, this is special bread, which is made in a certain kind of way that because of the ingredients and the way that it's made, etc. I'm not going to give you all of the longness, all of the, you know, all the background, but we don't have to wash on this bread. And it's been developed specially for that." So the priest turned around to him and said to him, "Let me get this right. God gives you a mitzvah, gives you a commandment to do something, and you're excited that you designed a way to live in a way which circumvents and removes the need for that mitzvah. Can you explain that to me? Because that something's missing there." And it's true if you think about it. And I want to ask that question a little bit about Mechiras Chametz. How does that fit with the Hashkafa of Mechiras Chametz about what Chametz is and what how we should relate to it, and whether the priest is right and whether the priest is wrong? Okay, because maybe he's thinking like a priest, which you can't blame him for, but maybe he's not thinking like a Jew. So unless he was a Jewish priest, we have those as well. let's have a look at the sheet. And we'll see about Mechiras Chametz. First of all, there is a Torah mitzvah to remove chametz. This, I'm sure, is not a surprise. Look at number one. Shivas yamim matzos tochem. For 7 days you have to eat matzah. Ach, for yom harishon tashvisu se'orim mivaseisem. On the first day, which Chazal understands to be the day prior to Pesach, we'll see that translated in a minute, you must tashvisu. You must, what is the word lahashvisu? From the word Shabbat. On the word Shabbat, it must rest, it must be inactive, all deactivate, let's call it, all of the leaven from your home. Why? Because if you were to come to eat the chametz on Pesach, then that's a very serious avera, miyom rishon ad yom shvi'i, from the first to the seventh day. So there is a mitzvah to remove the chametz, and it gives a clear reason. The reason is because if you don't remove it, you might come to eat it, and you mustn't eat it. This is an example, and we've seen them in the past, of a geder min haTorah, where the Torah itself draws a fence, if you like, around its own mitzvah. We're very familiar with the idea that Chazal, that the rabbis create rabbinic fences around mitzvahs, like muksa and such like. But we see this in the Torah. They got that structure from the Torah itself. And we see that this here. We see other examples as well. For example, there is a mitzvah on the Nazir not to drink wine, and not only not to drink wine, but not to even eat grapes in case he comes to drink wine. That's also a Torah mitzvah, not to eat grapes. There is a Torah mitzvah not to bear a grudge. We saw this. In case a person comes to take revenge, which is another Torah mitzvah. There is a Torah mitzvah not to make 3D images of statues, even though they're not idolatrous. That's a Torah prohibition. In case a person comes to do idolatry, etc. So this is quite a well-known Shomer Negiah. A person's not allowed to touch another person sexually in case that person might come to a false sexual relation, if that's a person that they're not allowed to be with. So we see this example here. If you look at the Targum, number 2, you'll see the Targum here, and the Targum Unkelus is very similar, uses an interesting word for Tashbisu. Shivat Yomin Patira Teichlum. You have to eat matzah for 7 days. Baram, however, mipalgut yama demikame. Halfway through the day before, already gives a halachic perush. Halfway through the day before, okay, the mikame chag, the day before chag, tevaklun chamir mibatech. Tevaklun, from the word bitul. That's how it translates tashvisu. It doesn't say you have to destroy it. It says tevaklun. Make it batel. And from here we see that the halacha has arisen, which we're not talking about today, of bitul chometz, where a person says and makes a declaration on the morning of the day before Pesach that all the chometz, as far as I'm concerned, mentally is as if it's not, doesn't exist, and I'm not getting into all of the discussions as to how bitul chometz works, is it hefker, is it something else, not getting into that now. But clearly the word tashbisu doesn't just mean to destroy. There are two other mitzvahs, number 3 and number 4. One is very famous, Bal Yamatzeh. Look at number 3, Shivat Yamim Se'or Lo Yamatzeh Bivatechem. For 7 days you mustn't find, there mustn't be present in our homes any chometz. In number 4, Matzah Yeachel, Shivat Yamim Ve'lo Yira'elecha chometz. There shouldn't be seen any chometz, etc. So between those three mitzvahs, the positive mitzvah to destroy the chometz, and the two negative mitzvahs that it shouldn't be present and it shouldn't be seen, one way or the other, the chometz has to go. The question is, how does it go? And if you look for a second at the Ksava HaKabbalah in number 5, and I could have brought many sources like this, he explains that the Torah could have said the word Tava'arun, destroy or burn, but it didn't. Number 5, Tashvisu. Says the Ksava HaKabbalah, Midalai Ama Tava'arun, since it doesn't say burn or destroy, Kamai, as it says in other places, Bi'arati HaKodesh, it could say destroy and it doesn't. This is where the rabbi saw that the idea that you can get rid of your chometz in other ways than just destroying it. She'ein hashbata b'kol makom ela hafsaka. Hashbata just means hafsaka, to break, to make sure that it's not active anymore. U'bitul b'leiv oisel lo hafsaka b'pamachat, and he goes on to explain how bitul works in that way. Now, from the very beginning, all the way back to the Mishnah, one of the options of getting rid of your chometz, if you don't have to physically get rid of it, you just have to remove it, was to sell it. Jews are good at selling things, and chometz is no exception. See number 6. Number 6 is the Mishnah already in the beginning of Pesachim. It says the following. Kol shah shemutah le'echol, all the time on Erev Pesach that you're allowed to eat chometz, you can do other things with it as well. Ma'achil le'behema, you could give it to your animals to eat. Lachaya, to you can feed it to the beasts of the field, or la'ifas to the birds. Umoichra l'nachri, you can sell it to a non-Jew. Umutah b'hanasa, because you can get all benefit from it. Now, there the Mishnah is talking about selling it. Selling it, finished, done. Meaning, why do I have to throw all the chometz away? It's Erev Pesach, I have expensive chometz. Sell it to a non-Jew, and let the non-Jew keep it. And there it's talking about a sale, one-off and permanent, never to return. Okay? Sell it to a non-Jew, that's definitely possible. And in fact, that was, in many ways, the minhag. Have a look in number 7. We're not talking about selling it and getting it back after Pesach. We're just talking about selling it. There's a fascinating machlokes by Shammai and Beit Hillel in number 7. We see how the minhag evolved originally. At the top of page number 2. Berishayna haya oirim. At the beginning, they used to say, Ein moichrin chometz anachri. You're not allowed to sell your chometz to a non-Jew. You can't give them it as a gift. The non-Jew has to finish it before the Zman arrives for the end of Chometz. So originally they used to say you can sell it to a non-Jew, but you better make sure that they eat it, or you better make sure that they get rid of it, because one way or the other the Chometz can't be there. Ad shebar Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva came along, v'laman, and he learned differently. Shemoichrim, you can sell it. V'noisne matan, and give it a gift. Ad b'shav, even a minute before. We're not worried about the Chometz still existing once it belongs to a Jew. To a non-Jew, excuse me, correct. The Amar Rabbi Yossi explains here the Tosefta. Eilo Dibrei Beis Shammai, because the original statement that even the non-Jew has to finish it, that is the word. These are the words of Beis Shammai. Eilo Dibrei Beis Hillel, but according to Dibrei Beis Hillel, we saw that the non-Jew doesn't have to finish the Chometz, you just have to get rid of it. And Hechriya Rabbi Akiva, the style of Dibrei Beis Hillel. Which is fascinating, because Beis Shammai took the view that actually destruction means destruction. And even if it's in the hands of a non-Jew, the minute the Pesach comes in, the Chometz has to be gone. But we don't rule like Beis Shammai, we rule like Beis Hillel, and the Chometz, as long as the Chometz is not owned by you, it can be sold to a non-Jew. And in fact, that was the Minhag. We find in number 8, an interesting story of somebody who had Chometz that they were keeping as a pikadon, as a deposit for somebody else. Look at this interesting story, number 8. Says the Gemara in Pesachim, Ma'aseh ba'adam echad. There was a one person, Shehifkid disakya malei chametz etzel Yochanan chakuka. And they deposited a disakya. What's a disakya? So the disakya is a Greek word from du, meaning to, sack. Two sacks. It's one of those saddlebag things that goes over a horse or a donkey with a sack on each side. Okay? So this fellow, Yochanan chakuka, had these two saddlebags of chametz with him. Unikuva akbarim, and the mice nibbled a hole in the bags. The hayachomets mitzbatzets, but you're saying the chomets was dribbling out. And he was going nuts on Erev Pesach. This guy's chomets is dribbling all over the floor. What am I going to do? Balitnei Rebbe. So he went to ask a shayla, like you do in these situations. He ran to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and says, What should I do? The fellow's chomets is all spilling out. Shari Shona, the first time he asked him, he said to him, Hamtein, wait. Shneer, then the next, he said, Hamtein, wait. Shlishit amalo Hamtein, the third, he said, wait. Revi'ed amalo Hamtein, the fourth, he said, wait. Chamishi amalo, and at the fifth hour of the day, he said, Seil machro b'shuk. Now go and sell it in the market, so at least you can keep the money, so that you'll minimize the loss to whoever's deposited the chometz. But he waited and waited and waited, and eventually he sold it, and that was that. Even though the non-Jew obviously is not going to eat it before the Zman for Bi'ur chometz arrives, that's good enough. So that was the minhag originally. The Mishnah records it. You sold your chometz, you got rid of it, and you never saw it again. Fine. Comes along the Tosefta and gives an interesting other example. Look at number 9. The Tosefta says the following: Yisrael v'goy shehayu ba'im b'sfina. If a Jew and a non-Jew were together on a ship, now it's a bit difficult because you're on a ship. It's Erev Pesach. And obviously the idea is you're not going to get back to land in time to do any kind of selling in the marketplace. What are you going to do? Could throw it all over the side. But this is one option that it gives you. Harizei moichro lenachri. You can sell it. The Jew can sell it to the non-Jew. But noit nama matana. Or you can give it as a gift. V'chozer v'lokeach mimenu la'achar Pesach. And then he can take it back from the non-Jew after Pesach. Bilvat sheyitnu lo b'matana gemura. As long as the gift is a real gift. Meaning you can give the chometz to the non-Jew on the ship, and there can be an understanding, perhaps, between you, but after Pesach he'll sell it back or give it back to you. But the sale has to be a real sale. You can't pretend. It has to be a real sale. But that you can do. This is the first mention, and it's very old, it's a Tosefta, so it's from the time of the Tanaim, going back 1900 years. This is the first mention of anything that looks like what we do today as Mechirat Chometz. You can give it to a non-Jew, you can sell it to a non-Jew, and you can even get it back from after Pesach, as long as it's real.
He shouldn't be on a ship.
Maybe he was stuck on a ship. There are all sorts of stories, though. There are stories of Rabban Gamliel and his crew who used to go to Rome to try and beg for mercy in the Hadrianic persecutions. They got back late. This is one of the reasons why maybe in the Seder night when they were all sitting in Bnei Brak, and remember their story, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, they were all sitting in Bnei Brak. Why were they all in Bnei Brak? I mean, Bnei Brak's a lovely place to go for Yom Kippur. Or why would they all be there? They don't live there. They all have their... So one of the suggestions is they were coming late off the ship. They could only get to Bnei Brak, etc. Yes. Oh, so what's a matana gemura? Good. So a matana gemura means it is. He can do what he likes. He can use it. He can eat it. He can throw it off the side of the ship. No, he does not have to return it. He does not have to return it. It could be that the understanding that you have with him, nod, wink, wink, or is nod, wink, wink acceptable? Maybe that's not acceptable. Also, maybe this is only an emergency. This is on a ship. You have no other options. What if you're just sitting at home and you have other options? Can you rely on this? Can you do this? Or is this only on the sort of emergency scenario on a ship? So that we have to look at. If you look at the Bahag is a commentary of the Gaonim. Okay, the Baal Halachos Gedolos from around the 7th, 8th century. He adds three words on the end of this. Look, and this is going to introduce us to the real, to the topic today. Look at number 10. Yisrael v'goy shehayu b'ayim v'sfina. He quotes this Tosefta. There is a Jew and a non-Jew on a boat. V'hayu chometz b'yad Yisrael. And the Yisrael had chometz he needs to get rid of. Haridim moichra nochri on notal amatana. Exactly the same as the Tosefta. V'chayzi v'lokechum manu la'echa Pesach. And he can get it back after Pesach. And look at these last three words. Bilvad shelo yarim. Now, bilvad shelo yarim is a little bit different to matana gemura. What is yarim? What's a harama? A trick. Says the Bahag, but no tricks. No tricks. What does that mean, no tricks? What's a harama? We have to define that very clearly. Similarly, Rav Amram Gon, from the same period as the Bahag, he quotes the Tosefta and he adds a few words of his own. Number 11. Yisrael shemacha chemtza legoy. He's not quoting the Tosefta, he's now giving the halacha. If a Jew sold chometz to a non-Jew, or shenatan lo b'matana gemara, he gives them a complete gift, a clear, outright gift. Im mashach goy oisa, if the non-Jew makes a proper kinyan, he does meshicha, he takes it. Ve'ein sham ha'arama, and there are no tricks going on. Ve'ein ragil la'asoyz kach b'shah shalem, and he doesn't do this every year. Because the minute he does it every year, he can smell a rat. Okay? Especially on a ship. But not if it's a sinking ship. Okay? Eremoreahu, but it's in one-off. The non-Jew can buy the chometz, and the Jew can buy it back again after Pesach. My timer, what's the reason, says Rabbi Amram Gon? Came in the canyon, goyva meshicha, the non-Jew bought it properly, he did a proper kinyan, kamlei berushul, say he now owns it. But Kaimalana, we paska, not like Beit Hashamai, but we paska like Beit Hillel, Chometz Shel Nochri Acha Pesach Mutzav Achila. The non-Jewish Chometz, Chometz owned by non-Jew during Pesach, after Pesach a Jew can eat that Chometz, as long as it wasn't owned by a Jew after Pesach. If the Chometz was owned by a Jew during Pesach, that's obviously a problem. Okay? This is a problem with duty-free. When you go fly straight after Pesach, you go to the duty-free shops in Ben-Gurion. So then one has to check out which of the shops sold the chometz, which of the shops didn't sell the chometz, and if the shop didn't sell the chometz, then it's potentially problematic. And that, of course, includes whiskey. According to everybody, apart from the one shita, that whiskey is not chometz gomor, okay? Which we don't pasca like, but it's based on the fact that it's distilled, as opposed to just, cooked like beer. And maybe the distilling process changes the halachic status of the whiskey. But that's a one-off. According to everybody else, 99.99% of Paiskim whiskey is chometz. I heard an interesting story, actually, once, about a Jewish fellow who became a Baal Tshuva. And he was very sincere, and he wanted to become religiously observant. And as he was in the, if you like, advanced stages of becoming more observant, somebody tipped him off and said, well, you realize you'll have to get rid of your whiskey collection. So he had a very substantial whiskey collection. He says, what are you talking about? He says, well, it's chometz which was owned by a Jew on Pesach, and you never sold your chometz. He says, of course I never sold my chometz. I wasn't religious. So he goes, well, I'm so sorry. You have to get rid of it. You have to throw it all down the sink. So he was very unhappy with this particular approach. He says, I've got thousands and thousands of dollars worth of whiskey. Did you tell me I have to pour it down the sink, otherwise I can't become religious? So it was a whole story, and he was very sincere about it. But in that particular case, my understanding was, he got upset that for the Isser of Chometz Sha'avar Alav Pesach, which he didn't do on purpose, he could rely on the one opinion that whiskey wasn't real Chometz. and therefore he didn't have to pour his whiskey collection down the sink. Don't rely on that, but according to everybody else, whiskey really is chametz. Now, so Rav Amram Gon says, no cheating. No haroma. If you do this every year, then we know that you're not really sincere. And the Ritzvah explains this position, number 12. Shelo ya'arim, don't do any haroma. Aval in herim v'hu ragil lasot kein. If this is what you normally do, oh yes, it's mechiras chometz time, let's go to the Rav and sell our chometz every year. V'kol shanim, every year, limkor l'goy, kodem ha-pesach, and every year before Pesach, you sell to a non-Jew, v'litl ha-pesach, and then you take it back after Pesach, kamsinon. We penalize that person. But who also like the chametz is also to them, the chol Yisrael, to every other Jew la'achar Pesach. Sha'asau ki'ilu hu chametz shal Yisrael. Because there's a Ritzvah, who are you trying to kid? This isn't really chametz that belongs to a non-Jew. This is chametz that belongs to a Jew. Hamufkad b'rishus ha'goy. It's just deposited with the non-Jew. But you know, and he knows, and everybody knows, that it's really your chametz. Shu also la'achar Pesach, and therefore it's also after Pesach. Really, these two people had intention. It was just a deposit. He was just looking after the Jews' chametz. Everybody knows that. They were just playing tricks. The king who be the Shalmi, and he says, that's how I feel the Shalmi works as well. So, you see that there were some opinions that felt very strongly that if this is something you do every year, then how can that possibly work? It's a harama. It's a trick. It's a scheme. The problem with the word scheme is, as you know, and it's been in the news a lot with the whole Panama tax thing, there are schemes and there are schemes. And even in English, the word scheme can have a negative, scheming type connotation. Or it can be a tax scheme. A tax scheme is perfectly legitimate. There's a difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion. Okay? Tax evasion is illegal. You can go to jail. Tax avoidance is not paying any more tax than you have to. And structuring your affairs in such a way as to minimize your tax liability. Okay? When do we call a haroma a haroma, and when do we not call it a haroma? So if you look in the Beis Yosef, look over on page 3, please. You see, the Beis Yosef has a slightly different feel. He quotes Rabbeinu Yerucham. He says, Rabbeinu Yerucham Kaza Alat Osentas of a Shem Habahag. And he says, I'm on page 3 at the top. Okay? He feels these words, Bilvat Shelo Yarim, are not the words of the original Tosefta, but they're the addition of the Bahag. The Bahag added those words. Bilvat Shelo Yarim. The Einu Meivin Tvaro, says the Beit Yosef of Yosef Karo, Sirius Paisek, Shulchan Aruch. He says, I don't understand what he's talking about. Dehashari Litna Lagoy B'matana, you're allowed to give it to a non-Jew as a matana, we see this. V'lachsho V'lekach HaPesach. And you're allowed to take it back after Pesach. We see that in the Mishnah with the Tosefta. Ve'ein lecha ha'arama gedola mizo. Surely there is no greater ha'arama than that. And it's fine. So what's the problem with a ha'arama? There's nothing wrong with a ha'arama. Va'afilo hachi, shari, nevertheless it's permitted to do that. Ma'achashim moti b'rishus ha'lagamre, since the non-Jew really acquired it completely, it's fine. The Ashi says it could be Shelo Yarim when it says don't make a scheme. Ka'amar Hainu Lama Shalolim Korlo Ligitin Al Tanan. Don't put a condition into the sale itself. Meaning, if you make the sale conditional, you have to sell it back to me after Pesach. Then, okay, that's no good. But if you just sell it, even though the understanding is, yes, nod, nod, wink, wink, you're going to sell it back to me, but you don't have to, then what's wrong with that? That's not an inappropriate scheme. That's an appropriate scheme. Yes?
Well, I was wondering about an example and brings a question. Let's say the two men are on the ship, and the Jew sells to the boy his cargo on the ship for what at that time is a reasonable price. They land somewhere, and they find this price has skyrocketed.
Okay.
And
that depends on the contract.
The boy says, I have to give it back. I want to give it back to you at the price you sold.
That depends on what they provide in the contract, meaning there will be a sale price in the contract. They can agree whatever sale price they want. They can agree the price as now, they can agree the price as then. There's obviously going to be a risk of currency fluctuations, price increases, etc. That just depends on what they write. That can be anything they want.
So why would the boy buy this if there's no profit for
him? Because there may be profit, because there may be a certain profit margin if the non-Jew wants to pay all that money for the chometz. OK? Okay? Maybe they'll do that. For example, we'll see in a minute, the state of Israel sells its chametz. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. And there is one particular person from Abu Ghosh advisors, and we'll talk about the price that he pays and the deposit that he puts down. Okay?
Okay. Now, let's talk about that now.
It's depending on the Jew. When is a haram a haram and when it's not a haram? So we see two approaches here so far. The Gaonim are very unhappy about haram. They say, look, if you do this every year, this is clearly not real. It's a trick. You're just getting around it. And the Beit Yosef says, no, I don't agree. As long as it's not a conditional sale, it's not a trick. But if it is a trick, it's an acceptable scheme. It's a tax. It's tax avoidance, not tax evasion. Says the halacha, you know, there's such a thing as a haram. When is it appropriate and when not? Let me give you some examples. What about the Hetzer Mechira? This is still relevant. You go to the shops now, the Hetzer Mechira. You go buy your lemons in the shops. Most of the shops are selling Hetzer Mechira lemons. How does that work? They were grown during Shemitah, they were harvested during Shemitah, and they were sold during Shemitah or after Shemitah. And yet they were the farm involved that sold their land to a non-Jew. And therefore, that's okay. Or is it okay? Is that a haram or is that not a haram? Like the joke, you know, of the fellow smoking on Shabbos, but it's okay because he sold his lungs to a god. or is that not the case? Is it not appropriate to joke? No. Hetzer Mechira is a very valid hetzer. It's made by senior Talmid Chachamim, and even if it's a haroma, maybe it's an acceptable haroma. What about a prosbul? A prosbul at the end of the Shemitah cycle, a person signs a prosbul, it means they can collect a loan that was otherwise wiped out by the end of the Shemitah cycle. Now, if the Torah says that at the end of the Shemitah cycle, the loan should be wiped out, how can you circumvent that by inventing some document whereby you sell your loan to the Beis Din, and since the Beis Din loans are not wiped out, then you can still enforce your loan after the Shemitah? If the Torah doesn't want you to do that, how are you getting around that? What about a Heta Iska? What's a Heta Iska? A Heta Iska enables you to borrow and lend money and charge Jews interest. So one second, if the Torah says you can't charge a Jew interest, so how are you structuring something in such a way that now you can charge a Jew interest? And by the way, when you go to Bank Mizrahi, you'll see on the wall they have a Heta Iska. Otherwise they can't pay you interest and you can't pay their interest. Usually in Israel it's you pay them interest. If you have a mortgage, or even if you have a current account, you still pay them somehow or other. I don't know how that works, but I have this strange idea from Chutzlaris that at the end of the month there's more money in my savings account, but here there's always less, even if I didn't take anything out. Okay, maybe I just have to learn better and how it works here. So let's answer some of these questions. The Rambam in the Halacha number 14 in the Mishnah, in the Perush Al Mishnah, he makes a distinction between two kinds of harama. There's a harama on something on a bechor, which is a firstborn animal. I'm not getting into how that works, but the Mishnah itself allows that. It says Keitzad Ma'arlimim Al Bechor. How do we structure, says the Mishnah, harama, a scheme in order to avoid the problem of a firstborn animal? It's a bit of a nightmare having a firstborn male animal these days. Because back in the day of the Beis HaMikdash, so you give it to the Kohen, it will be a big simcha, they'd eat it, there'd be a big ceremony. Today, there is no Beis HaMikdash, there's no Kohen, we can't offer up a bechor. We'll talk more next week about why not. So what do? We don't give it to the Kohen these days, it just stays in the farm and it basically runs the place. There's nothing you can do with it. You can't eat it, you can't work it, you can't shecht it, you can't do anything with it. It just kind of runs the farm. Nobody wants a bechor. So everybody wants to find a way to avoid having a bechor. Now, the Rambam chimes in there and says, Hatachbula. Now, Hatachbula is probably a scheme of some kind, right? Hatachbula hamuteret nikra harama. If your scheme is acceptable, it's called a harama. V'she'ein hamuteret, if it's unacceptable, it's called a mirma. Interesting distinction. Mirma is bad scheming. Ha'arama is permitted scheme. Why? So I want to share with you an important basic hashgapic idea about this that I saw in the writings of Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, the Rosh Hashiva of Gush. And I've even given you some of the article here we'll read together in a few minutes. He makes an important first point, and he says, look, there are two reasons that we keep mitzvahs. There are two accounts of Matan Torah in the Chumash. In Sefer Shmos, we see that Matan Torah happens with great fire and smoke, and it's very scary, and the mountain is, according to the Midrash, held over our heads, etc. It's a Kabbalah Miyura. We accept the commandments. Why? Because that's what God told us to do. No questions. That's how it is. The mountain's over our heads. We do them because we are commanded. We're mitzvim. But if you look, says Rav Lichtenstein, at the accounts of Matan Torah in Devarim, it's very different. It's much more ahava based. It says Hashem spoke to us panim mil parim, panim. We were mekuravim. We were brought close to Hashem at the mountain. Says Rav Lichtenstein, there's a second reason why we keep mitzvot. We keep mitzvot because it's the right thing to do. Because we understand them. For the same reason that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov kept mitzvot to the extent that they kept mitzvot, and that's a whole discussion. They didn't keep them because they were mitzvim. They had no mitzvah to keep them in the most. They kept them because they were connected and it was the right thing to do. 99.9% of the time, these two reasons come together. We are mitzvim, we keep them miyura because we were commanded, and we also understand them and they're the right thing to do. But what happens where there is a mismatch? Very occasionally, a mitzvah is still technically binding, but it's now become the wrong thing to do. We'll talk about how that works in a minute. Yes? Right. To act appropriately, not because you're mitzvah, but because you're banim ahovim. Banim atem l'Hashem elokecha. It says there the word banim. We relate to Hashem as banim. What happens where the reason for the mitzvah has now, for some reason, become kind of circumvented? I'll give you an example. It says don't lend money to people on interest and charge Jews interest. What's that talking about? That is talking about a situation where I'm rich, or let's put it the other way. You're rich, okay, I'll give you a bracha. You're rich, he's poor, he needs the money, he's desperate, he comes to you, and he says to you, I need money, please can you help me as a chesed? And you say, yeah, you pay me back 4% compound, no problem. That's immoral. You can't do that. A Jew deserves a free loan. But what happens if it's not like that? What if it happens if I go to see Mizrahi Tfachot, and I say, look, you know, neither of us are rich. It's just a deal. I want to do a business deal with you. You'll lend me a few hundred thousand shekels. I'll invest it in this. You'll get paid back this. I'll get paid back this. This will enable me to expand this and you to do this, etc. It's a business deal. It's not what they were talking about in the mitzvah and the Torah. Maybe there, it's appropriate to restructure it in such a way that I can't charge interest because at the end of the day, the Torah really wasn't talking about that scenario. Maybe that's appropriate. So too are the prosbul. We see that Hillel instituted prosbul. Why? Because the Torah says you have to release loans at the end of the Shemitah year. And don't you dare think about not, says the Torah, not lending money as it gets close to the Shemitah year because you're worried that the loan will never be repaid. That's a terrible thing to do. Comes along Hillel, 1500 years after the Torah was given, and says, look, people aren't lending anymore. People are doing exactly what the Torah says they mustn't do. And therefore, the net result of prosbul is not to help the poor people, but it's actually now harming the poor people. Or the net result of this mitzvah to release the note alone. And therefore, the actual mitzvah in the Torah is counterproductive. Now he says what we need to do is we need to keep the letter of the law, because we're mitzvim, we can't just not do it, but we have to restructure it in a way to achieve the spirit of the law. Because if we do it the way it was originally put, we'll actually not be keeping the spirit of the law. That is the purpose of a haramah. With that in mind, have a look at Rav Moshe Lichtenstein here. He says in number 50, let us return now to the matter of haram. Haram is a halachic mechanism intended to circumvent the formal aspect of a prohibition. In other words, it is a stratagem that provides the possibility of evading the obligation the obligating imperative by creating conditions in which the detail of the mitzvah do not apply. However, all that this can do is provide an exemption from the letter of the law. But it is incapable of providing an answer to the fact that the spirit of the law is not fulfilled, not achieved, and that the person who utilizes the circumvention fails in that way. Formally, he doesn't violate any prohibition, but spiritually, his cause is flawed. I wonder about the case of the Mazonas bread. Yeah? Are you really achieving the spirit of the law by eating Mazonas bread? Harama is therefore regarded as a negative phenomenon, and despite its efficacy, technically, there is no justification to use it. All this is true in a case where there is no great gap between the mitzvah and its objective. To the extent that the reason for the mitzvah and the details of the law no longer go hand in hand, the situation changes. If the reason for the mitzvah is no longer meaningful to us, and our entire obligation to the mitzvah stems from the absolute imperative of the master of the universe, meaning if the only reason we're keeping the mitzvah is because we're mitzuvim, but really the mitzvah makes no sense anymore, then creating a mechanism that evades the formal prohibition but is no longer problematic for the reason is no longer a factor. In all such cases, harama becomes legitimate and perhaps even desirable. And you can read the rest of it yourself. He talks about heta mechira, he talks about chametz. The heta mechira these days is not designed to circumvent Shemitah, it's designed to protect the yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. There's a whole different set of reasoning involved, which I'm not getting into now. And therefore, many people think that, okay, yes, maybe the heta mechira is to some degree a haram. And selling Eretz Yisrael to a non-Jew with all of the problems that involves. But the purpose of the heta mechira is absolutely consonant with legitimate hashkafic approaches. To strengthen Eretz Yisrael, to strengthen the yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, etc. I'm not getting into a debate now about heta mechira, yes, heta mechira, no. But there's no question that the people who allow heta mechira understand that in this case it's an appropriate harama. Maybe two mechiras chametz, but maybe not. For example, why am I selling my chametz? Why did the Torah say sell your chametz? Because you might come to eat it. Good. So if I have a half a bag of pasta in my cupboard, okay? And as you know something, sell it to a non-Jew. It's fine. Is that acceptable? Probably not. But if I have $1,000 worth of whiskey, or maybe if I'm a trader, I have $100,000 worth of whiskey in a warehouse at the other side of town. Was the purpose of the mitzvah to remove chometz in order to destroy my livelihood? No, that was not the purpose of the mitzvah to remove chometz on Erev Pesach. So maybe now if I can create something, some kind of a legitimate haroma, whereby I will no longer own the chometz, and therefore won't lose my parnasa, but at the same time I'm not likely to eat chametz on Pesach. Why is that not an acceptable thing to do? And that's where the Beis Yosef is coming from by saying, I don't understand your problem with this haroma. But now it's going to depend on the circumstances. So let's go on to page 4, and we will deal with the halacha lemaisa and see how mechiras chametz really works. Have a look with me, please, at number 17. Already the Tur by the 14th century makes reference to the minag of mechiras chometz, and he doesn't say anything about a boat. Okay, number 17. If you gave it or you sold it to a non-Jew, kaidim a pesach before pesach. Mutar, that's fine. Bilvashi is nedu b'matana gemura. As long as it's a proper sale, and the Shulchan Aruch puts some details on that. What does it mean a proper sale? Number 18. Im machru or not le'ein yehudi. If you gave it or sold it to a non-Jew. Shemichutz labayit kodem pesach, and you get the stuff out of your house before Pesach, meaning he says you can't sell your chometz and have it sitting downstairs in a cupboard. Afal pisha Yisrael machru le'ein yehudi, even though the Jew sold it to the non-Jew, v'yodeyavo, and you know about the non-Jew, shehu yig, shelo yigabo, that he won't touch it, klal at all. El Yishmerenu, he will actually look after it, love on behalf, on his, not on his behalf, but he'll look after it. Ad la'acha Pesach, until after Pesach. V'yachzo v'yitnan lo, and then he'll give it or sell it back. Mutar. He says, as long as the chometz is out of your house, that's fine. U'bilvashi yitnan lo matana gemura, you have to make sure the sale works. B'lishon tanai, it can't have any conditions in it. You can't sell it on condition that he sells it back, or gives it back. O'shiyin karena lo mechira gemura, b'dava mort. A matana on condition that you're going to give it back, or a sale on condition, says that won't work. So the Shulchan Aruch basically makes two stipulations. Number one, make sure the chometz is out of your house. Number two, make sure that the sale is a real sale. Now, if you fast forward another couple of hundred years to the time of the Bach, something interesting has changed in the Jewish community, which is that the Jewish community is now very big into the liquor trade. Meaning, how much chometz normally does a Jew really own? Not so much. If you think about it, back in the day when flour and grain were untreated, then grain is not chometz, and flour is not chometz. If you had regular flour from regular grain from before Pesach, that's not chometz. Today the flour is chometz, because they wash the flour before it gets in the bag, before it gets in your cupboard. But back in the day they never did that, so how much chometz are you really going to own? A few noodles? A few bits of old bread? But what's it going to be, really? So, okay, so sell it to a non-Jew. How much can there be to sell anyway? But by the 17th century already, the Jews were very big in the liquor trade. And once you're in the liquor trade and you have any number of kinds of whiskey and schnapps and this and that made from different kinds of grain, so you have very large amounts of chometz, and it's simply not practical to just take it all out of your premises and deliver it to the non-Jew. It just won't work. So comes along the Bach in number 19, and he says the following. Let's have a look together. Ubedina Zo, in today's countries, where he was living in Poland in the 17th century, Sheroy Masa Matan Hu Beyayin Sarov. Most people make their money from Yayin Sarov. Yayin Sarov is whiskey. Okay? V'iyev Shalayim L'machram L'goy V'chutz L'bayit. It's just not possible for us to get it out of the house. It's not half a pack of noodles anymore. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of bottles of whiskey. So he says, you know something? I'll let you keep it in the house. Yesh lahatir v'inyan zeh sheyimkor l'goy kol chomet shebacheda. So you can sell the non-Jew all the chomets in the room. V'gam hacheda atzmo yimkor l'goy. And you can sell the room to a non-Jew as well.
Even the room.
Even the room. The room you'll lease to the non-Jew, and all the chomets inside it. So even though it's in your premises, so the non-Jew will have the chomets, and the non-Jew will have the room.
That's Arkham?
Ah, we'll get to that in a minute. You could do it in a number of different ways, and we'll see how we do it.
What is Bach?
The Bach is the Beit Chadash, Rav Yol Sirkus. He lived in Poland in the 1600s, and he was one of the main gedolim in Poland in that time. Okay? And he goes on to say, Umihud Sarich Linsur Lugoy Gam HaMachteach, the non-Jew has to have the key, he has to be able to get in. The Imloy came, because if he doesn't have the key, came in the Das Yisrael, Ach Zoro, Liknot, Chavit, Zel, Ach Pesach, since the Jew is intending to buy this Chavit back after Pesach, Havelech Kamarchi Beisel V'Gamru Pitzuk Damim, the Yud Gimel, what happens is he agrees it all on the 13th, the HaMachteach B'yad HaSoicher, And the key gets in the hand of the non-Jew who leases it. Beleil Yudalit, already before the night of the 14th, Sha'al HaSoichel is dock, and now you also don't have any obligation of Bedikas Chometz. If you can get rid of the room as well before the night of the 14th, before Erev Pesach, you don't have to check the room for Chometz either, because the whole thing is off your hands. It's all sold to a non-Jew. It's not like a normal situation where you buy with a kinyan. The nishara maftech biyadam ocher, and a person would keep the key. In this case, we won't let you keep the key. The v'chomet yesh lahachmir, because we have to be extra machmir with chomet. The non-Jew has to have the key. V'tua, furthermore, kevin shem maftech biyad Yisrael, if the Jew is to keep the key, the yochel ikanis lecheder, he can go in and out of the room whenever he wants. The little achomet misham, loy samchadata de goy de mechira gemura. It's not a real sale, meaning if the Jew is walking in and out all through Pesach of the room with the chometz in it, come on. He says, who are you trying to kid? That's not a real sale. You didn't really sell it then. And aside the Ein Mechira El Lahasiv El Aviv Chometz, it's just a ritual thing. The Jew is just getting rid of his chometz somehow, and it's not a real sale. The Alkiyot of the Zekos of Rabbi Yeruchim, that's what Rabbi Yeruchim said, B'Shem Abahag, Dovat Shelo Yarin. In other words, everybody's drawing the lines in a different place. Originally, it has to be out of your house. Otherwise, that's a haroma. Says the Bach, you know something, these days, even in your house is okay, as long as you don't have the key. Because that's a haroma. That's an unacceptable haroma. Ubechubat ha-Rashba, and he quotes the Rashba, Uvoda ha-Valosh v'tosef to the Haina Shelo Yarin, she-yinir she-nishar shum koyach etzal Yisrael. It has to be clear that you, the Jew, have no power anymore, the chometz over the chometz, she-machal agoy, that he sold to the non-Jew, El Mechira, Chatucha, Upsuka, it is completely a done deal. He owns it. All the more so, you can't put a seal, some kind of a lock on the room. That the non-Jew can't get in, that's absolutely prohibitive. There's no sale at all. Because your actions are actually undermining your words. There was a rumor always that Rabbi Riskin, when he was doing Mechiras Chometz for the people of Efrat, would always, I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what I used to hear. Maybe anyone here live in Efrat? They used to say that Rabbi Riskin would arrange for the non-Jew who bought the Chometz to randomly go to one of the homes of the people in Efrat on Chol HaMoed Pesach and demand the Chometz, just so that people would take it seriously. I don't know if that's true or not true. Sounds like the kind of thing Rabbi Rifkin would do, you know, because he would think out of the box in that way. But it has to be real. There has to be a real sale somehow or other. So the Bach says, look, and this basically is the minig that we have today. The Chometz can stay in the house, but the non-Jew has to have the key. The non-Jew has to have access, and that is how we basically do it today. Just go over the page, and we'll talk a few about some of the details of Mechiras Chometz. Even in the time of the Bach, every Jew was doing their own Mechiras Chometz. There wasn't a communal Mechiras Chometz. Yes?
Yeah. When we sell the first nowadays,
yes.
Do we have to give the first key?
Good, we'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about that in a minute. The way we do it mamash today. Already in the 17th, 18th century, the rabbis began to notice that people were just messing up their Mechiras Chometz. Meaning every Tom, Dick and Harry was putting together a contract with his Jewish next-door neighbor to sell their Chometz. The Magen Avraham already says, the non-Jewish neighbor, sorry, yes, good job, you're on the testing. Okay, the non-Jewish neighbor. Number 20, the Magen Avraham says, Mihu tzarech sheyoma hareini moche lecha Chometz. The Jew has to say, I sell you the Chometz. The loika hamayim, not like your average person, the hoi poloi, sha'omrim hareini moche lecha mavteach. They say, I'm selling you the key. What do people know? They're not telling the Chachomim. They used to say to the non-Jews' neighbor, I'm selling you the key to my house, okay? So that doesn't do anything. Even B'diyevet, the whole thing, Osir, he's messed everything up. Shehari lo machru klal. He didn't sell anything. So because of this and many other problems, it's a complicated area. Not everybody's a lawyer. Not everybody wants to be, okay? The minhag arose over the last 250 years. Let the rabbi deal with it. Not that you sell your chometz to the rabbi. It's surprising how many people think the rabbi buys the chometz. But the rabbi now acts as your shaliach. We have now a shlichut. We have a communal sale. We have, if you like, frozen the minhag in place as a communal sale, a comprehensive sale. And now basically what we do is we appoint the rav, or whoever it is, as the shaliach. And he, on our behalf, sells the chometz through a central agency in whatever country you live. There's different people. Do it through the OU, you'll do it through the CRC, you'll do it through the London Basin, you'll do it through the Rabbanut. But the Rabbanim act as shlichim on your behalf, and you actually end up selling the chometz. That's how the minhag developed. Even so, there were people who didn't like it. There were people who said, look, it's still not real. One of the arguments that was made is that the government in Russia used to impose a sales tax on contracts. And they never imposed a sales tax on Mechiras Chometz. And people turned around, some of the poskim turned around and said, you see, even the non-Jews know that it's not real. Meaning, believe me, if they could tax it, they would tax it. But they don't tax it, why not? Because they say, it's just a Jewish mishigas, but they sell the Chometz, it's not real. And the Alter Rebbe of Liadra, Shmuel Shneur Zalman of Liadra, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, he actually had a provision in his contracts that said that this contract can be and should be translated into Russian if need be, and any tax that the Tsar decides is payable has to be payable because of this issue. But still there were people that didn't like it. The Vilna Gaon was very against the whole thing. Look at number 21 in Maaseh Rav, it's recorded in the name of the Vilna Gaon. Shalolim kor shum davar chametz. Do not sell chametz. Ki im mechira olamit. Unless it's a permanent sale. You cannot sell chometz, says the Vilna Gaon, and then buy it back after Pesach. And in the second line he says, Acha Pesach ein likach min ha-shuk, ma she'oipi mekemach shel Yisrael. And if Jews do sell the chometz and buy it back, don't use it after Pesach. Okay, v'sham v'yesh, or whiskey, he doesn't like it. V'sheichar shel Yisrael, ki ha-machriya garua. Ha-machira, sorry, ha-garua. Because the sale's not a real sale. And up until this day, there are people who, in the footsteps of the Vilna Gaon, they really don't like the whole thing. And they say things like, you shouldn't sell chometz gomor. Meaning, you can sell stuff that's not really chometz. Mixtures of things that might have chometz in them. But things which are real, bona fide, 100% chometz, like pasta or whiskey, there are those that say you shouldn't sell them, you should throw them out. However, the minhag is pretty established that we do taka sell chometz, and the poskim, the vast majority of poskim, for the last 200 years have been perfectly happy with the idea of selling chometz, as long as, and we'll see how the conditions work, we don't give the keys away anymore, but the non-Jew has to have access. And that's why we find that many rabbis, when they sit down with you and they sell the chometz, they insist that you have to write down where it is. They at least have to have a phone number. That in theory, if the non-Jew wanted to get a hold of it, he'd be able to call you. Obviously, we're not in the business of giving the keys to every house in Israel with chometz in it to these nice people in Abu Ghosh. Okay, I brought you at the bottom of the sheet there a reference to a very interesting video. You can go online and you can see the official tekes where the two chief rabbis and Netanyahu, they sit down with the mayor of Abu Ghosh and this fellow, what's his name? Jabba Hussein, for the last 15 years has been buying the chometz of the whole of Eretz Israel. He buys $150 billion worth of chometz. Okay? He says for 7 days he's the richest man in Israel. He puts down a deposit of 20,000 shekels. Okay? So a deposit that towards the $150 million is paid, $1 billion is paid. Now you'll realize that's not such a serious deposit. You know, 20,000 shekels out of 600 billion shekels is 0.00003 whatever percent. Okay, so okay, the deposit's not very high, but the idea is if Jabba Hussein wants after Pesach to complete the sale, then it's within his rights to do that. If he wants to, you know, go to the World Bank and borrow $150 billion to buy all the chometz in Israel, even if he wants to do that, we'll find a buyer for a higher figure somewhere or whatever. And go back each year. So look at the end. And the same guy every year. So look, at the end of the day now, because he puts the deposit down and we sign a full contract, etc., so then this is an acceptable procedure. Excuse me. As I said, as long as at least in principle the non-Jew can get in. Now, these days we put all sorts of bells and whistles on our Mechiras Chametz, and let's just talk about that for a few minutes. The gentleman over here talked about it before. Let me just mention maybe six or seven points. Excuse me. First of all, as I said before, in theory, if the non-Jew wants to claim the chometz, they can come and claim the chometz. That is a binding sale, and therefore people write down the value, the location, and maybe even the phone number in order to get hold of the chometz. The second thing, the bittel chometz that we make on the night of the 14th and also the day of the 14th, that does not include the chometz that we sell. Okay? And that's a very important point. The bittel chometz is just not anything else that we forgot about. But the chometz that we sell is not included in the bittel chometz, and therefore we are talking about a d'oraita ownership of chometz. We have not done bittel chometz on that. And therefore, the sale really has to work. And therefore, they put every possible kinyan in place when they're, not with you and the Rav, but the ultimate seller when he does the deal with Jabbar Hussein, they put every kinyan you could possibly imagine that might work with a non-Jew, and I've written down at the bottom of page 5 some examples. A kinyan is, of course, a if you like, a formal halachic transfer of ownership. They use a kinyan kesef, where they put down a down payment. A kinyan agav, like you said before, where they sell some real estate, and the real estate is sold together with the chometz. They make a shtar. They do a kinyan suda, where they lift up a piece of cloth or whatever it is, a chalipin, to exchange it. They do a kinyan chotzer. They do a handshake. They do a verbal affirmation. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to do a hefka based in hefka. He used to, as a based in, transfer it to the non-Jew as well. They do everything they possibly can to make that work. And therefore, hopefully it works. And certainly, if it's good enough for all the people who allow Mechiras Chometz, it's certainly good enough for me. In terms of the shlichus that you do with the Rav, so in theory, that doesn't require a kinyan at all. Meaning, when you want to sell your Chometz, in theory, you could just call somebody up. You could do it over the internet, Chabad.org, sell hundreds of thousands of people's chometz over the internet, that's fine. However, lamaise, in practice, when you sit down with the Rav to sell the chometz, they tend to say something like, you know, lift up my pen, whatever, that basically, that you acquire his pen, and he acquires the right to act as your shaliach in order to sell the chometz, but you don't really need to do that. And if you want to, you can keep the rabbi's pen, but the minhag is not to do that, because then you'll have to get a new rabbi next year. there are other details that you need to be aware of. If you're traveling, for example, you may want to do a special kind of mechira that includes the room where the chometz is, and the chometz should be in a special place, marked chometz, etc. That sale has to go into effect, or you will want it to go into effect, the night before Pesach already, so that when you're already in Miami or wherever you're going, you don't anymore have a chiyuv of bedikas chametz in the place where the chametz remains. You just have to tell the rav that that works. And so he'll put that in place in the contract. Also, there are issues with time zones. If you're going to California for Pesach, or if you're coming from California, you need to work out when the chametz is coming back into your ownership. The last thing that you want, if you're in California, is for the chametz to be reacquired by you when Pesach goes out in Israel. Because that's 11 hours before Pesach goes out in California. This year it's less of an issue because Shabbos comes straight on the heels of Pesach, and therefore no one's going to get the chametz back for another 24 hours. Yes?
There's another interesting situation here in Israel. I live in Karnei Shomron. The question is, whether it belongs to the state of Israel.
Oh, really? Interesting. Whether Karnei Shomron belongs to the state of Israel. Okay, so we can get into a political discussion in a minute of whether Karnei Shomron belongs to the state of Israel, but we'll save that for another time. Let me just get into a last couple of points. There are some people who want to sell their shares in companies that own chametz. If I have shares in Walmart or Sainsbury's or whatever it is, and they own a lot of chametz, does that mean I own the chametz? Really, the answer halakhically is no, unless I have a controlling shareholding in Walmart, in which case I wouldn't be giving shirin at the OU Israel Center. I'd be sitting near a pool somewhere else, but maybe still I'd be here. You never know. Okay? So that actually is probably not a problem. Pots and pans. There are certain contracts for sales of chametz that say things like, I sell all the food that might be stuck to the pans and the bleas, etc. There are some poskim that say, actually, that makes a mockery of the whole thing. Because there's no non-Jew in the world who's interested in buying the bits of chametz that are stuck to the pan, etc. So there are people that don't like that at all. The pots and pans themselves are specifically not included in the sale. Otherwise, you'd have to go and toivel them all after Pesach. So that's also an own goal. I just need to finish in just 1 second, excuse me, sorry. But I finished with a couple of other points, which is as follows. I brought you at the end, I'm not going to read you the whole thing, Rav Eliezer Melamed, in the Pliny Halacha, he talks about this, and Halacha Lamaita, he says, and I think this is, I'm not a posek, so I'm not telling anybody what they should or shouldn't do, but I think that this is really the correct approach. Mechirat chametz at the end of the day works. There's no question, according to the vast majority of poskim, it's not an inappropriate haroma. However, the real purpose of the mechira is to avoid a serious problem in parnasa. It's not designed for half a pan of, you know, soup mix, half a packet of soup mix in the cupboard. Even though, technically speaking, the mechira chametz will work for your half pack of soup mix, it's not the right thing to do. The half pack of soup mix should be thrown away. All of these days you can give them to gemachim. There are many gemachim that collect unwanted chametz before Pesach, and they will keep it, and they will sell it totally legitimately, and after Pesach they will give it to very needy Jewish causes, and I recommend strongly that people do that. But when it comes to real money, real hefset, meaning you have a few $100 worth of whiskey, there is no question that mechiras chametz works. And you probably don't want to give that to the Gemach. Maybe you do as well. Why shouldn't the people receiving after Pesach also have your Glenlivet? But in the event that you don't want to give the Glenlivet away to the poor and needy, it is legitimate to sell it as long as one fulfills the requirements that we've talked about. And therefore, I think Mechiras Chometz is a very interesting example of the development of a minhag, which does achieve the letter of the law and also the spirit of the law, as long as we use it right. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week we'll talk about Korban Pesach. Yes, sir. Shares in holding companies are even less of a problem than shares in actual companies. Unless you have a controlling interest in something that has comments, then it's unlikely to be a problem. We should ask the Shaila.